The routine that Merrin and Taita had adopted since leaving the settlement on the high plateau was to march for 4 consecutive days and take a break on the 5th. On that day they repaired any damaged equipment, rested the men and horses, and sent out hunting and foraging parties to replenish their supplies. 17 days after they had left Nontu with his wives, they passed the last cattle post of the Shilluk and entered territory that seemed uninhabited by anything other than large herds of antelope. Most were of a species they had not encountered before. They also came across a new species of trees and plants, which delighted Taita and Fen. She had become as ardent a botanist as he was. They looked for signs of cattle or human presence, but found none.
"This is the land of the Chima," Nakontu told Taita.
"Do you know it well?"
"No, but I know the Chima well enough. They are secretive and treacherous. They keep no cattle, which is a true sign that they are savages. They eat game meat, and they prefer that of their fellow men above all else. We must be on our guard, lest we end up on their cooking fires."
With Nakontu's warning in mind, Merrin gave special attention to the construction of the zareba each evening and placed additional guards over the horses and mules when they let them out to graze. As they travelled further into Chima territory, they came across evidence of their presence. They found hollow tree trunks which had been hacked open and the bees in them smoked out. Then they came across a cluster of shelters that had not been inhabited for some time. Of more recent origin were a string of footprints in the mud banks of the river, where a party of 30 men had crossed in single file from east to west. They were only a few days old. From the beginning, the new Shilluk wives, none of whom were much older than Fen, had been fascinated by her. They discussed the colour of her hair and her eyes among themselves and watched her every move, but kept their distance. Finally, Fen made friendly advances, and soon they were conversing happily in sign language, feeling the texture of Fen's hair, squealing with laughter, together, at feminine jokes, and bathing naked each evening in the shallow pools of the river. Fen appealed to Nakontu for instruction, and picked up the Shilluk language as swiftly as she had Egyptian. In ways she was still a child, and Taita was pleased that she had convivial company closer to her own age to divert her. However, he made certain that she never wandered too far with the other girls. He kept her close so that he could rush to her aid at the first unnatural chill in the air or any other inkling of an alien presence. She and Taita took to speaking in Shilluk when there was a risk of being overlooked by their adversary. "Perhaps it is one language that even the witch will not understand, though I doubt it," he remarked. "At least it is good practice for you." They were deep into Chima territory when, at the end of a hard day's march, they built the zareba in a grove of tall mahogany trees. Wide pastures of grass with fluffy pink heads surrounded it. The horses favoured this grazing, and herds of antelope were already feeding there. It was clear that they had never been hunted, for they were so tame and confiding that they allowed the archers to approach within easy bowshot. Merrin declared that the following day they would rest, and early in the morning he sent out 4 hunting parties. When Taita and Fen set off on their customary foraging expedition, Merrin insisted that Shofar and 2 other troopers went with them. "There is something in the wind that makes me uneasy," was his only explanation. Taita preferred to have Fen to himself, but he knew not to argue when Merrin smelt something in the wind. He might not be a psychic, but he was a warrior and could smell trouble. They returned to camp late in the afternoon to find that only 3 of the hunting parties Merrin had sent out had returned before them. At first they were not alarmed, expecting the last band to return at any moment. But an hour after sunset, a horse belonging to one of the missing hunters galloped into camp. It was lathered with sweat and wounded in 1 shoulder. Merrin ordered all the troopers to stand to arms, an extra guard on the horses and bonfires to be lit to guide the missing hunters home. At the first flush of dawn, when it was light enough to backtrack the wounded horse, Shabako and Hilto took out a heavily armed search party. Taita left Fen in the care of Merrin, and he and Nakontu rode out with them. Within a few leagues of the camp they rode under the outspread branches of a clump of silverleaf trees and came upon a grisly scene. Nkontu, with his tracking skills and his knowledge of the Chima's habits, knew exactly what had taken place. A large band of men had concealed themselves among the trees and lain in ambush for the hunters. Nkontu picked up an ivory bracelet that one had dropped. This was made by a Chima. See how crude it is. A Shuluk child could have done better, he told Taita. He pointed out the marks on the tree trunks where some of the Chima had climbed into the branches. This is the way the treacherous jackals like to fight, with stealthy cunning, not courage. As the four Egyptian horsemen rode beneath the overhanging branches, the Chima had dropped down upon them. At the same time, their comrades had leapt out of hiding and stabbed the horses. The Chima jackals pulled our men from their horses, probably before they could draw their weapons to defend themselves. Nkontu pointed out the signs of the struggle. Here! They speared them to death. See the blood on the grass. Using plaited bark rope, the Chima had hung the corpses by the heels from the low branches of the nearest silver leaves and butchered them like antelope. They always eat the liver and entrails first, Nkontu explained. Here is where they shook the dung from the tripes before they cooked them on the coals of their fires. Then they had quartered the corpses and used bark rope to tie the severed limbs onto carrying poles. The feet, cut off at the ankle joints, were still hanging from the branches. They had thrown the heads and hands onto the fires, and when they were roasted they had chewed off the palms and sucked the flesh from the finger bones. They had split open the skulls to scoop out the baked brains with cupped fingers, then scraped off the cheeks and taken out the tongues, a great Chima delicacy. The broken skulls and small bones were scattered all around. They had not bothered with the dead horses, probably because they were unable to deal with such a heavy load of meat. Then, with the physical remains, the clothing, weapons, and other equipment of the troopers they had murdered, they had set off into the west, moving fast. "Shall we hunt them down?" Shabako demanded angrily. "We cannot let the slaughter go unavenged." Nkontu was just as eager to take up the pursuit. His eyes shot with bloodlust. But after only a moment's thought, Taita shook his head. "There are 30 or 40 of them, and 6 of us. They've had a head start of almost a full day, and they'll be expecting us to pursue them. They will lead us deeper into difficult territory and ambush us." He looked around at the forest. "Certainly they will have left men to spy on us. They are probably watching us at this moment." Some of the troopers drew their swords, but before they could rush among the trees and root them out, Taita stopped them. "If we do not follow them, they will follow us, which is what we want. We will be able to lead them to a killing ground of our own choosing." They buried the pathetic skulls with the severed feet, then returned to the zareba. Early the next morning they mustered into column and rode out again on the endless journey. At noon they broke the march to rest and water the horses. On Taita's orders, Nkontu slipped into the forest and made a wide circle through the trees. As stealthily as a shadow, he cut the back trail of the column. The prints of 3 sets of bare feet were superimposed on the horse tracks. He made another wide circle to rejoin the column and report to Taita. "Your eyes see far, old man. 3 of the jackals are following us. As you foretold, the rest of the pack will not be far behind." That evening, they sat late around the fire in the zareba, laying plans for the morrow. The next morning, they started the march at a sharp trot. Within 1/2 league, Meron ordered the pace increased to a canter. Swiftly they opened the gap between themselves and the Chima scouts, whom they knew would be following. As they rode, Meron and Taita were studying the terrain they were passing through, seeking ground that they could turn to their advantage. Ahead, a small isolated hillock rose above the forest, and they angled towards it. Around its eastern slope they found a smooth, well-beaten elephant road. When they followed it, they saw that the hillside above was steep, covered with a dense growth of kitar thornbush. The vicious hooks and densely intertwined branches formed an impenetrable wall. On the opposite side of the road, the ground was level, and at first glance, the open forest seemed to afford little cover for an ambush. However, when Taita and Merin rode out a short distance among the trees, they found a wadi, a dry gully cut out by storm water that was deep and wide enough to hide their column, men and horses. The lip of the gully was only 40 yards from the elephant road, within easy bowshot. Quickly they rejoined the main column. They stayed on the elephant road for a short distance, then Merin stopped again to conceal 3 of his best archers beside the road. "There are 3 Chima scouts following us, 1 for each of you," he told them. "Let them get close, pick your shots, no mistakes. Quick, clean kills. You must not allow any of them to escape to warn the rest of the Chima who are behind them." They left the 3 archers and rode on along the elephant road. After half a league, they left it and made a wide circle back to the gully under the slope of the hill. They led the horses down into it and dismounted. Fen and Shilluk girls held the animals, ready to bring them forward when the troopers called for them. Taita waited with Fen, but it would take him just an instant to run to Merin's side when the time came. The men strung their bows and lined up below the lip of the wadi facing the elephant road. At Merin's command, they squatted down out of sight to rest their legs and bow arms and to prepare themselves for combat. Only Merin and his captains watched the road, but to conceal the silhouette of their heads, they stood behind clumps of grass or bushes. They did not have long to wait before the 3 Chima scouts came along the road. They'd been running hard to keep up with the horses. Their bodies shone with sweat, their chests heaved, and their legs were dusty to the knees. Merin lifted a warning hand, and none of the men stirred. The scouts passed the ambush at a rapid trot and disappeared along the road into the forest. Merin relaxed slightly. A little later, the 3 archers he had left to take care of the scouts slipped out of the forest and dropped into the wadi. Merin looked at them questioningly. The leader grinned and pointed to fresh splashes of blood on his tunic. The scouts had been accounted for. They all settled down to await the arrival of the main body of Chima. A short time later, from the forest on the right flank, the querulous alarm call of the grey lorry, "Kee-wee! Kee-wee!" rang out. Then a baboon barked a challenge from the top of the hill. Merin lifted a fist as a signal to his men. They knocked their arrows on the bowstrings. The leading file of the main Chima raiding party trotted round the curve in the elephant road. As they drew closer, Merin studied them carefully. They were short, stocky, and bow-legged, and wore only loincloths of tanned animal skins. Even when the entire band came into view, it was difficult to make an accurate head count, for they were bunched in a tight formation and moving fast. 100 at least, maybe more. "We're in for some rich sport, I warrant you," Merin said with anticipation. The Chima were armed with an assortment of clubs and flint-headed spears. The bows slung across their shoulders were small and primitive. Merin judged that they would not have the draw weight to kill a man at more than 30 paces. Then his eyes narrowed. One of the leaders carried an Egyptian sword slung over his shoulder. The man behind him wore a leather helmet, but of an archaic design. It was puzzling, but there was no time to ponder it now. The head of the Chima formation came level with the white stone he had placed beside the road as a range marker. Now the entire left flank was exposed to the Egyptian archers. Merin glanced left and right. The eyes of his men were fixed on him. He dropped his raised right hand sharply, and his archers jumped upright. As one man, they drew their bows, paused to make good their aim, then loosed a silent cloud of arrows to arc high against the sky. Before the first struck home, the second cloud rose into the air. The arrows fluted so softly that the Chima did not even look up. Then, with a sound like raindrops falling on the surface of a pond, they dropped among them. The Chima did not seem to realize what was happening to them. One stood gazing down, perplexed at the shaft of the arrow protruding from between his ribs. Then his knees buckled and he crumpled to the ground. Another was staggering in small circles, plucking at the arrow that had buried itself in his throat. Most of the others, even those who had received mortal wounds, did not seem to grasp that they had been hit. When the third flight of arrows dropped among them, those still on their feet panicked and bolted, screaming and howling in every direction. like a flock of guinea fowl scattering under the stoop of an eagle. Some ran straight towards the wadi, and the archers dropped their aim. At close range, none of the arrows missed their mark. They struck deep into living flesh with meaty thumps. Some went right through the torso of the primary target and flew on to wound the man behind him. Those who tried to escape up the hill ran into the palisade of Kitar thorn bushes. It stopped them in their tracks and forced them back into the hailstorm of arrows. "Bring up the horses!" Merrin yelled. Fen and the other girls dragged them forward by the lead ropes. Taita swung onto Windsmoke's back, while Merrin and his men slung their bows and mounted. "Forward! Charge!" Merrin bellowed. "Take the blade to them!" The horsemen bounded up the side of the wadi onto the level ground and shoulder to shoulder charged at the disordered rabble of Chima, who saw them coming and tried to turn back up the slope. They were caught between the thorn wall and the glittering bronze circle of swords. Some made no attempt to escape. They fell to their knees and covered their heads with their arms. The horsemen stood in the stirrups to stab them. Others struggled in the thorn like fish in the folds of a net. The troopers cut them down as if they were firewood. By the time they had finished their grisly work, the slope of the ground below it was thickly strewn with bodies. Some Chima were writhing and groaning, but most lay still. "Dismount," Merrin ordered. "Finish the work." The troopers moved quickly over the field, stabbing any Chima who showed a spark of life. Merrin spotted the man with the bronze sword still slung across his back. Three arrow shafts stood out of his chest. Merrin stooped over him to retrieve the sword, but at that instant Taita shouted, "Merrin, behind you!" He used the voice of power, and Merrin was galvanized. He leapt up and twisted aside. The Chima lying behind him had feigned death. He had waited until Merrin was off guard, then he jumped to his feet and swung at him with a heavy, flint-headed club. The blow narrowly missed Merrin's head, but glanced off his left shoulder. Merrin pivoted in close, blocking the weapon's next swing, and drove the point of his sword clean through the Chima, transfixing him from sternum to backbone. With a wrench of his wrist, he twisted the blade to open the wound, and when he jerked it clear, a great gush of heart blood followed it. Clutching his damaged left shoulder, Merrin bellowed, "Kill them all again! Make sure of them this time!" Remembering their comrades hanging like sheep on slaughter racks, the troopers went to work with gusto, hacking and stabbing. They found a few Chima hiding in the Kitar thickets and dragged them out, squealing like pigs, to the slaughter. Only once he was certain of them would Merrin allow his men to pick over the corpses and gather up their own spent arrows for reuse. He himself was the only casualty. Bare to the waist, he sat with his back to a tree trunk while Taita examined his shoulder. There was no bleeding, but a dark bruise was spreading over it. Taita grunted with satisfaction. "No bones broken. In 6 or 7 days, an old dog like you will be as good as new." He anointed the shoulder with a salve and twisted a linen bandage into a sling to hold the arm comfortably. Then he sat beside Merrin as the captains brought the spoils they had gathered from the Chima dead and laid everything out for them to examine. There were carved wooden lice combs, crude ivory trinkets, water gourds, and packets of smoked meat, some still on the bone, wrapped in green leaves and tied with bark string. Taita examined it. "Human. Almost certainly the remains of our comrades. Bury it with respect." Then they turned their attention to the Chima weapons. Mostly clubs and spears with heads of flint or obsidian. The knife blades were of chipped flint, the handles wrapped with strips of uncured leather. "Rubbish. Not worth carrying away," Merrin said. Taita nodded agreement. "Throw it all on the fire." At last they examined the weapons and ornaments that were clearly not of Chima manufacture. Some had evidently been taken from the corpses of the four ambushed hunters, bronze weapons and recurved bows. Leather helmets and padded jerkins, linen tunics, and amulets of turquoise and lapis lazuli. However, there were others of greater interest. Well-worn old helmets and leather breastplates of a type that had not been used by Egyptian troops for decades. Then there was the sword that had almost cost Merrin his life. Its blade was worn, the edges chipped and almost destroyed by rough sharpening against granite or some other rock. However, the hilt was finely worked and inlaid with silver. There were empty seatings from which precious stones had been prized or had dropped out. The engraved hieroglyphics were almost obliterated. Taita held it to the light and turned it from side to side, but he could not make out the characters. He called for Fen. "Use your sharp young eyes." She knelt beside him and pored over the engravings, then read out haltingly, "I am Lottie, son of Lottie, best of 10,000, companion of the Red Road, general and commander in the guards of the divine pharaoh Mamoz. May he live for ever."
"Lottie," Taita exclaimed. "I knew him well. He was second in command under Lord Acre of the expedition that Queen Lostris sent from Ethiopia to discover the source of Mother Nile. He was a fine soldier. So it seems that he and his men reached at least as far as this place."
"Did Lord Acre and all the rest die here, or were they eaten by the Chima?" Merrin wondered. "No. According to Tiptip, the little priest of Hathor with six fingers, Acre saw the volcano and the great lake. Besides, Queen Lostris placed 1,000 men under his command. I doubt that Chima could have slaughtered them all," Taita said. "I believe that they caught off guard a small detachment under Lottie, as they did our men. But did the Chima destroy a whole Egyptian army? I think not." While the discussion continued, Taita was surreptitiously watching Fen's expression. Whenever the name of Queen Lostris was mentioned, she frowned, as though seeking an elusive memory that was tucked away somewhere in the depths of her mind. "One day it will all return to her. Every memory of her other life," he thought. But he said aloud to Merrin, "We shall probably never know the truth of Lottie's fate. But his sword is proof to me that we are indeed following the trail to the south that Lord Acre blazed so long ago. We have spent too much time here already." He stood up. "How soon can we move on?" "The men are ready," Merrin said. They were cheerful as boys just released from study, sitting in the shade and joking with the Shilluk girls, who were serving them food and passing round jars of Dara beer. "Look at how eager they are. A good fight is better for their morale than a night with the prettiest whore in the Upper Kingdom." He started to laugh, then broke off to rub his injured shoulder. "The men are ready, but the day is almost done. The horses would profit from a short rest." "So will that shoulder of yours," Taita agreed. The sharp little fight seemed to have eliminated the threat of more Chima raids. Although they saw sign of their presence over the days that followed, none was of recent origin. Even these indications gradually became infrequent and eventually ceased. They passed out of the land of the Chima and rode on into uninhabited territory. Although the Nile was still shrunken to a trickle, there had evidently been heavy rain in the surrounding countryside. The forest and savanna teemed with game, and grazing was abundant and rich. Taita had worried that by this time the troopers would be homesick and depressed, but they remained buoyant, their spirits high. Fen and the Shilluks delighted the men with their girlish pranks and high jinks. Two of the girls were pregnant, and Fen wanted to know how they had come to this happy state. When questioned, the girls dissolved into paroxysms of laughter. Fen was intrigued and came to Taita for elucidation. He made his explanation short and vague. She pondered it for a while. "It sounds rich sport." She had picked up the expression from Merrin. Taita tried to look grave, but he could not prevent a smile. "So I have heard," he conceded. "When I am grown, I should like a baby to play with," she told him.
"No doubt you will."
"We could have one together. Wouldn't that be rich sport, Taita?"
"To be sure," he agreed, with a pang, knowing it could never be.
"But in the meantime we have many other important things to do." Taita could not remember having been so filled with well-being since those long-ago days when he had been young and Lostris was alive. He felt quicker and more lively. He did not tire nearly as easily as he had done before. He attributed this mostly to Fen's company. Her studies advanced so swiftly that he was forced to find other ways to keep her mind working at or near its potential. If he allowed her to slacken for even a short while, her attention wandered. By now she spoke both Shilluk and Egyptian fluently. If she were ever to become an adept, she must learn the arcane language of the Magi, the Tenmas. No other medium encompassed the entire body of esoteric learning. However, the Tenmas was so complex and multifaceted, and had so little association with any other human language, that only those possessed of the highest intelligence and dedication could hope to master it. It was a challenge that brought out the best in Fenn. At first she found it was like trying to scale a wall of polished glass that gave no purchase to hand or foot. Laboriously she climbed a little way, then, to her fury, lost her grip and slithered down. She picked herself up and tried again, each time more fiercely. She never despaired, even when it seemed she was making no progress. Taita was making her face the magnitude of the task. Only then would she be ready to move on. The moment came, but still he waited until they were alone on their sleeping mats at night. Then he placed his hand on her forehead and spoke to her quietly until she sank into a hypnotic trance. When she was fully receptive, he could begin to plant the seeds of the Tenmas in her mind. He did not use the Egyptian language as the medium of instruction, but spoke directly to her in the Tenmas. It required many such nocturnal sessions before the seeds took tenuous hold. Like an infant standing for the first time, she took a few uncertain steps, then collapsed. The next time she stood more firmly and confidently. He was careful not to tax her too hard, but at the same time to keep her moving. Aware that the strain might stale her and bend her spirit, he saw to it that they still spent enchanted hours at the bowboard, or in easy but sparkling conversation, or wandering together in the forest in search of rare plants or other small treasures. Whenever they passed a likely stretch of gravel in the riverbed, he unstrapped his prospecting pan from the back of his mule, and they worked the gravel. While he swirled the slurry he had picked up, Fenn used her eyes and nimble fingers to pick out lovely semi-precious stones. Many had been polished by the waters into fantastic shapes. When she had filled a bag, she showed them to Merrin, who made her a bracelet with a matching anklet. One day, below a dried-up waterfall, she plucked a gold nugget the size of the fist joint of her thumb from the pan. It sparkled in the sun and dazzled her. "Fashion for me a jewel, Taita," she demanded. Although he had been able to hide it, Taita had felt twinges of jealousy when she wore the ornaments Merrin had made for her. "At my age?" He smiled at his folly, like a lovelorn swain. Nevertheless, he devoted all his art and creative genius to the task she had set him. He used the silver from the hilt of Lottie's sword to make a thin chain and a setting from which he suspended the nugget. When it was done, he worked a spell into it to give it protective qualities over its wearer, then hung it round her neck. When she looked down at her image in a river pool, her eyes filled with tears. "It is so beautiful," she whispered, "and it feels warm on my skin, as though it were alive." The warmth, she had detected, was the emanation of the power with which he had endowed it. It became her most prized possession, and she named it the Talisman of Taita. The further south they travelled, the lighter and more buoyant the mood of the company became. All at once it struck Taita that there was something unnatural about it. It was true that the way was not as hazardous as it had been when they were lost in the great swamps or in the lands of the Chima. But they were far from home. The road was endless and the conditions arduous. There was no reason for their optimism and light-heartedness. In the fading light of day he was sitting beside a river pool with Fenn. She was studying the trio of the elemental symbols of the Tenmas that he had drawn on her clay tablet. Each denoted a word of power. When they were conjugated, they became so portentous and charged that they could be safely absorbed only into a mind that had been prepared carefully to receive them. Taita sat close to her, ready to protect her if the shock of the conjugation produced a backlash. Across the pool, a giant black-and-white kingfisher with a russet chest was hovering over the water. It dived, but Fenn's concentration on the symbols was so intense that she did not glance up at the splash as the bird struck the surface, then rose with a flutter of wings, and a small silver fish clamped in its long black bill. Taita tried to analyse his own feelings more closely. There was only one good reason he could think of for his own euphoric state of mind: his love for and delight in the child at his side. On the other hand, there were compelling reasons why he should be afraid for both their sakes. He was charged with a sacred duty to protect his pharaoh and his homeland. He was travelling to a confrontation with a powerful evil force without any clear plan, a lone hare setting out to scotch a marauding leopard. All the chances were against him. Almost certainly the consequences would be dire. Why, then, was he doing so seemingly without any reckoning of the consequences? Then he became aware that he was having difficulty in following even this simple line of reasoning. It was as though impediments were being placed deliberately in his way. He kept feeling a strong impulse to let it go and to lapse back into a complacent sense of well-being and trust in his own ability to overcome obstacles as he encountered them, without having any coherent plan. "It is a dangerous and reckless state of mind," he thought, then laughed aloud as though it were a joke. He had disrupted Fenn's concentration. She looked up and frowned. "What is it, Taita?" she demanded. "You warned me that it was dangerous to become distracted when I was attempting to conjugate the rational coefficients of the symbols." Her words brought him up sharply, and Taita realized how grievously he had erred. "You are right. Forgive me." She looked down again at the clay tablet in her lap. Taita tried to focus on the problem, but it remained hazy and unimportant. He bit hard into his lip and tasted blood. The sharp pain sobered him. With an effort, he was able to concentrate. There was something he must remember. He tried to grasp it, but it remained a shadow. He reached for it again, but it dissolved before he could catch it. Beside him, Fenn stirred again and sighed. Then she looked up and set aside the clay tablet. "I cannot concentrate. I can feel your distress. Something is blocking you." She stared at him with those candid green eyes, then whispered, "I can see it now. It is the witch in the pool." Quickly she removed the nugget from round her neck and placed it in her palm. She held out both of her hands. Taita placed the periapt of Lostris in his own palm. Then they linked hands and formed the circle of protection. Almost imperceptibly, he felt the alien influence recede. The words that had troubled him jumped into his mind. He had been trying to remember the warning of Demeter. "She has already infected you with her evil. She has begun to bind you with her spells and temptations. She will twist your judgment. Soon you will begin to doubt that she is evil. She will seem to you fine, noble, and as virtuous as any person who ever lived. Soon it will seem that I am the evil one who has poisoned your mind against her. When that happens, she will have divided us, and I will be destroyed. You will surrender yourself to her freely and willingly. She will have triumphed over both of us." They sat together in the protective circle until Taita had thrown off the enervating influence of Eos. He was amazed by the support Fenn rendered him. He could feel the strength flowing from her soft little hands into his own gnarled and knotted ones. They had shared more than one lifespan, and together they had built a fortress of the spirit within walls of marble and granite. Darkness fell swiftly, and bats flitted over the pool, wheeling and swooping on the insects that rose from the surface of the water. On the opposite bank of the river, a hyena whooped mournfully. Still holding Fenn's hand, Taita raised her to her feet and led her up the bank to the zareba. Meron greeted them. "I was about to send out a search party to find you," he called cheerfully. Later, Taita sat with him and his officers at the campfire. They, too, were cheerful, and he could hear the laughter and the banter from the men at the far end of the enclosure. Once in a while, Taita thought to sober them with a warning. But he let them be. "They are also marching to the siren song of Eos. But I will let them go happily where they must go anyway. As long as I can hold firm, There will be time anon to recall them to their senses. Each day they pushed deeper into the south, and the determination of Merin and his men never wavered. One evening, as they built the zareba, Taita led Merin aside and asked, "What make you of the mood of the men? It seems to me that they are near the end of their endurance, eager to turn northwards for Aswan and their homes. We may soon be faced with a mutiny." He had said it to test the other man, but Merin was outraged. "They are my men, and I have come to know them well. It seems you have not, Magus. There is not a mutinous hair on their heads or breath in their lungs. They are as hot for the enterprise as I am." "Forgive me, Merin. How could I doubt you?" Taita murmured, but he had heard echoes of the witch's voice rise from Merin's throat. "It is good that I need not deal with sullen faces and surly moods on top of all else, in that Eos is making my lot easier," he consoled himself. At that, Fenn came running from the camp, calling, "Magus, Taita, come swiftly! The baby of Litoliti is bursting out of her, and I cannot get it back inside." "Then I shall come and save the poor mite from your ministrations," Taita scrambled to his feet and hurried with her to the encampment. With Taita kneeling beside the Shilluk girl, soothing her, the birth went swiftly. Fenn watched the process with horror. Each time Litoliti squealed, she started. In a pause between contractions, while the girl lay panting and drenched with sweat, Fenn said, "It does not seem such rich sport after all. I don't think you and I should bother ourselves with it." Before midnight, Litoliti had delivered of an amber-coloured son with a cap of black curls. To Taita, the arrival of the child was some compensation for the profligate expenditure of other young lives along this bitter road. They all rejoiced with the father. "It is a good omen," the men told each other. "The gods smile upon us. From now onwards our venture will prosper." Taita sought the counsel of Nakontu. "What is the custom of your people? How long must the woman rest before she can go on?"
"My first wife gave birth while we were moving cattle to a new pasture. It was past noon when her waters broke. I left her with her mother to do the business beside the road. They caught up with me before nightfall, which was as well, because there were lions about."
"Your women are hardy," Taita remarked. Nakontu looked mildly surprised.
"They are Shilluk," he said.
"That would explain it," Taita agreed. The next morning Litoliti slung her infant on her hip, where it could reach the breast without her having to dismount, and was up behind her man when the column pulled out at dawn. They continued on through well-watered grassy countryside. The sandy earth was gentle on the animal's legs and hooves. Taita treated any light injuries or ailments with his salves, so they remained in fine condition. There were endless herds of wild antelope and buffalo, so there was never any shortage of meat. Days passed with such smooth regularity that they seemed to merge into one. The leagues fell away as vast distances opened ahead. Then at last an escarpment of hills appeared on the misty blue horizon ahead of them. Over the following days it loomed larger until it seemed to fill half of the sky, and they could make out the deep notch in the high ground through which the Nile flowed. They headed directly for this, knowing that it would afford the easiest passage through the mountains. Closer still they could see each feature of the heavily wooded slopes and the elephant roads that climbed them. At last Merin could no longer contain his impatience. He left the baggage train to make its own pace and took a small party forward to reconnoitre. Naturally, Fenn went with them, riding beside Taita. They entered the gorge of the river and climbed up the rugged elephant road towards the summit of the escarpment. They were only halfway up when Nakontu ran forward and dropped on one knee to examine the ground. "What is it?" Taita called. When he received no answer, he rode forward and leant out from Windsmoke to discover what had intrigued the Shilluk. "The tracks of horses," Nakontu pointed to a patch of soft earth. "They are very fresh, only one day old." "Mountain zebra?" Taita hazarded. Nakontu shook his head emphatically. "Horses carrying riders," Fenn translated for Merin's sake. He was alarmed.
Strange horsemen? Who can they be so far from civilization? They may be hostile. We should not continue up the pass until we find out who they are. He looked back the way they had come. On the plain below they could see the cloud of yellow dust the rest of the column had raised, still three or more leagues away. We must wait for the others, then go forward in strength. Before Taita could reply, a loud halloo rang down from the high ground above and echoed off the hills. It startled them all. We have been discovered, but by Seth's pestilential breath, whoever they are, they speak Egyptian, Merrin exclaimed. He cupped his hands round his mouth and bellowed back up the pass. Who are you? Soldiers of the divine Pharaoh Nefertiti. Advance and be recognized, Merrin called. They laughed with relief as three strange horsemen came clattering down to meet them. Even at a distance, Merrin saw that one carried the blue standard of the House of Mamos, and as they came closer still, their features were clearly Egyptian. Merrin started forward to meet them. As the two parties came together, they dismounted and embraced rapturously. I am Captain Rabat, the leader introduced himself, an officer in the Legion of Colonel Arakton, in the service of Pharaoh Nefertiti. I am Colonel Merrin Cambyses, on a special duty for the same divine pharaoh. Rabat acknowledged his superior ranking with a salute of one fist clenched across his breast. Merrin went on. And this is the Magus, Taita of Galala. True respect dawned in Rabat's eyes, and he saluted again. Taita saw from his aura that Rabat was a man of limited intelligence, but honest and without guile. Your fame precedes you, Magus. Please allow me to guide you to our encampment, where you will be our honoured guest. Rabat had ignored Fen, for she was a child, but she was conscious of the snub. I don't like this Rabat, Fen told Taita in Shilluk. He is arrogant. Taita smiled. She had become accustomed to her favoured position. In this she reminded him strongly of Lostris when she had been sovereign of Egypt. He is only a rough soldier, he consoled her, and beneath your consideration. Appeased, her expression softened. What are your orders, Magus? Rabat asked. The rest of our contingent follows with a large train of baggage, Taita pointed at the dust cloud on the plain. Please send one of your men back to guide them. Rabat dispatched a man at once, then led the rest of them up the steep, rocky pathway towards the crest of the pass. "'Where is Colonel Arakton, your commander?' Taita asked, as he rode at Rabat's side. "'He died of the swamp sickness during our advance up the river.' "'That was 7 years ago?' Taita asked. "'Nay, Magus, it was 9 years and 2 months,' Rabat corrected him. "'The term of our exile from our beloved homeland, Egypt.' Taita realized that he had forgotten to include the time it would have taken them to reach this place since leaving Karnak. "'Who commands the army in Colonel Arakton's place?' he asked. "'Colonel Tinat Ankut. "'Where is he?' "'He led the army southwards along the river in accordance with the command of Pharaoh. "'He left me here with only 20 men and some women, "'those with very young children who had been born during the march, "'or those who were too sick or weak to continue. "'Why did Colonel Tinat leave you here?' I was ordered to plant crops, to keep a herd of horses ready for him, and to hold a base in his rear to which he could retire if he were forced to retreat from the wild lands to the south. Have you had news of him since he marched away? Some months later he sent back 3 men with all of his surviving horses. It seems that he had journeyed into a country to the south that is infested with a fly whose sting is fatal to horses, and he had lost almost all of his herd. Since those 3 arrived, we have had no word of him. He and his men have been swallowed up by the wilderness. That was many long years ago. You are the first civilized men we have met in all that time. He sounded forlorn. You have not thought to abandon this place and take your people back to Egypt? Taita asked, to gauge his mettle. I have thought of it, Rabat admitted, but my orders and my duty are to hold this post. He hesitated, then went on. Besides, the man-eating Chima and the great swamp stand between us and our very Egypt. "'Which is probably the most telling reason why you have remained at your post,' Taita thought. "'As they talked, they came out at the end of the pass, and before them stretched a wide plateau. "'Almost at once they felt that the air of this high place was more pleasant than that on the plains below. "'There were scattered herds of grazing cattle, and beyond them Taita was astonished to see the mud walls of a substantial military fort.' It seemed out of place in this remote and savage landscape, the first sign of civilization they had come across since they had left the fort of Kibui more than 2 years previously. This was a lost outpost of empire of which no one in Egypt was aware. "'What is the name of this place?' Taita asked. "'Colonel Tinat called it Fort Adari.' They rode among the grazing cattle, tall, rangy animals with huge humped shoulders, and a wide spread of heavy horns. The coat of each had a distinctive colour and pattern, no two alike. They were red or white, black or yellow, with contrasting blotches and spots. "'Where did you find these cattle?' Taita asked. "'I have seen none other like them. "'We trade them with the native tribes. "'They call them Zebu. "'The herds provide us with milk and beef. "'Without them we would suffer even greater hardship than we do at present.' Merrin frowned and opened his mouth to reprimand Robert for his lack of spirit, but Taita read his intention and cautioned him with a quick shake of his head. Although Taita agreed with both Fenn and Merrin on the fellow's worth, it would not be of any benefit to them to offend him. Almost certainly they would need his cooperation later. The fields around the fort were planted with durra, melons, and vegetable crops that Taita did not recognize. Robert told them the outlandish native names, and dismounted to pick a large, shiny black fruit, which he handed to Taita. "'When cooked in a stew of meat, they are tasty and nutritious.' When they reached the fort, the women and children of the garrison came out through the gates to welcome them, carrying bowls of soured milk and platters of durra cake. Altogether there were fewer than 50, and they were a bedraggled, sorry-looking lot, although they were friendly enough. Accommodation in the fort was limited. The women offered a small windowless cell to Taita and Fenn. The floor was of packed earth. Ants moved in military file along the rough-hewn walls, and shiny black cockroaches scurried into cracks in the log walls. The smell of the unwashed bodies and chamber pots of the previous occupants was pervasive. Rabat explained apologetically that Merrin and the rest, officers and men alike, would have to bunk with his soldiers in the communal barracks. With expressions of gratitude and regret, Taita declined this offer of hospitality. Taita and Merrin chose a congenial site half a league beyond the fort, in a grove of shady trees on the banks of a running stream. Rabat, who was plainly relieved not to have them in the fort, honoured Merrin's hawk seal and provided them with fresh milk, durra, and at regular intervals a slaughtered ox. "'I hope we are not to stay long in this place,' Hilto remarked to Taita on the second day. "'The mood of these people is so despondent that it will lower the morale of our men. Their spirits are high, and I would like them to remain so. Besides, all the women are married, and most of our men have been celibate for too long. Soon they will want to sport with them, and there will be trouble.' "'I assure you, good Hilto, that we will move on as soon as we have made the arrangements.' Taita and Merrin spent the following days in close consultation with the melancholy Rabat. "'How many men went south with Colonel Tinat?' Taita wanted to know. Like many illiterates, Rabat had a reliable memory, and he replied without hesitation, 623 with 145 women. Merciful Isis! Was that all who remained of the original 1,000 who marched from Karnak? The swamps were trackless and deep, Rabat explained. We were laid low with swamp sickness. Our guides were unreliable, and we were attacked by the native tribes. Our losses of men and horses were heavy. Surely you had the same experience, for you must have covered the same ground to reach Adari. Yes, indeed. However, the water was lower, and our guides faultless. Then you were more fortunate than ourselves. You said that Colonel Tinat sent men and horses back here. How many horses were there? Taita switched to a more agreeable subject. They brought back 56, all fly-struck. Most died after reaching us. Only 18 survived. Once they had delivered the horses, Colonel Teenat's men went south again to rejoin him. They took with them the porters I had recruited for them. So none of Teenat's men remains with you? One was so ill that I kept him here. He has survived to this day. I would like to question him, Taita told him. I will send for him at once. The sole survivor was tall but skeletally thin. Taita saw at once that his emaciated frame and thin white hair were relics of disease rather than signs of age. Despite this, he had recovered his health. He was cheerful and willing, unlike most of the other men under Rabat's command. "I have heard of your ordeal," Taita told him, "and I commend your courage and zeal. You are the only one who has, Magus, and I thank you for it. What is your name?"
"Tolas."
"Your rank?"
"I am a horse surgeon and a sergeant of the First Water."
"How far had you ventured south before Colonel Teenat sent you to bring back the surviving horses?"
"About 20 days' travel, Magus, perhaps 200 leagues. Colonel Teenat was determined to travel fast, too fast. I believe this increased our loss of horses."
"Why was he in such haste?" Taita asked.
Tolas smiled thinly.
"He did not confide in me, Magus, nor seek my counsel."
Taita thought for a while. It seemed possible that Teenat had come under the influence of the witch, and that she had enticed him southwards.
"Then, good Tolas, tell me about the disease that attacked the horses. Captain Rabat mentioned it to me, but he gave no details. What makes you think that it was caused by these flies?"
"It broke out 10 days after we first encountered the insects. The horses began to sweat excessively and their eyes filled with blood, so that they became half-blind. Most died within 10 or 15 days of the first symptoms occurring."
"You are a horse surgeon. Do you know of any cure?"
Tolas hesitated but did not answer the question. Instead, he remarked,
"I saw the grey mare you ride. I have seen many tens of thousands of horses in my lifetime, but I would think that mare is as good as the best of them. You might never find another like her."
"It is clear that you are a fine judge of horse flesh, Tolas, but why do you tell me this?"
"Because it would be a shame to sacrifice such a horse to the fly. If you are determined to go on, as I think you are, leave the mare and her foal with me until you return. I will look after her as though she were my own child."
"I will think on it," Taita told him.
"But to return to my question, do you know of any remedy for the fly sickness?"
"The native tribes hereabouts have a potion that they distill from wild berries. They dose their cattle with it."
"Why did they not warn Colonel Teenat of this disease before he left Fort Adari?"
"At that time we had no contact with the tribes. It was only when I returned with the fly-ridden herd that they came forward to sell us the medicine."
"Is it efficacious?"
"It is not infallible," Tolas told him. "It appears to me that it will cure 6 out of 10 horses that have been fly-struck, but perhaps those horses I tried it on had already been too long infected."
"What would have been your losses if you had not used it?"
"I cannot tell for certain."
"Then guess."
"It seems to me that some animals have a natural resistance to the sting. The very few, say 5 in 100, will show no ill effects. Others, perhaps 30 or 40 in 100, will sicken but recover. The rest die. Any animal that is infected but recovers is immune to any subsequent infection."
"How do you know this?"
"The natives know it well."
"How many of the horses in your care have been infected but have recovered?"
"Most were too far gone before we could dose them.
However, 18 are salted,"
Tolas answered promptly, then clarified. "They are immune."
"So, Tolas, I will need a good supply of this native potion. Can you procure it for me?"
"I can do better. I have had almost 9 years to study the matter. Although the tribesmen are secretive and will not divulge the recipe, I have discovered for myself the plant that they use. I have spied upon them while their women are gathering it."
"You will show it to me?"
"Of course, Magus," Tolas agreed readily. "But again, I caution you that even when treated, many horses will still die. Your grey mare is too fine an animal to expose to such risk."
Taita smiled. It was apparent that Tolas had fallen in love with Windsmoke and was angling for a way to keep her with him. I will take into careful consideration all you have told me. But now my main concern is to learn the secret of the cure. With the permission of Captain Rabat, I will take you into the forest tomorrow to gather the berries. It is a ride of several hours to reach the area where they grow.
Excellent. Taita was pleased. Now, describe for me the road to the south that you travelled with Colonel Tinat.
Tolas told them all he could remember, while Fenn made notes on a clay tablet. When he had finished, Taita said, "What you have told me, Tolas, is invaluable, but now you must describe how we will recognize the boundary of the fly territory."
Tolas placed his forefinger on the sketch map that Fenn had drawn on the tablet. "On about the 20th day of the journey southwards, you will come upon a pair of hills shaped like a virgin's breasts. They will be visible from several leagues off. Those hills mark the boundary. I counsel you not to take the grey mare further. You will lose her in the sad country that lies beyond."